Tonight on Arena, Tara Erocht and Barry Douglas on their upcoming live streaming concerts from the National Concert Hall. And 40 years on, we remember Ian Curtis and Joy Division. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Of all the art forms, perhaps it's the world of the performing arts that has been particularly hard hit these days, when the idea of bringing a live audience into a shared space with musicians, actors or performers is, for the time being anyway, totally unthinkable. As a result, the National Concert Hall in Dublin has come up with a plan to host a quartet of concerts live online every Friday evening from May the 29th through until June the 19th. To an empty auditorium. First up will be mezzo-soprano Tara Erocht with Deirdre Collins accompanying on piano. Then Bell X1 frontman Paul Noonan is there on June the 5th. Singer-songwriter Lisa O'Neill will be there on June the 12th. And the closing event is with pianist Barry Douglas. And I would guess that this will be pretty much the first time that either Barry Douglas or Tara Erocht, apart from rehearsing, has played to a totally empty National Concert Hall. But I'm delighted that they're both joining me on the line this evening. Let's start with you, Tara. Where are you holed up for lockdown? Where are you this evening?
Good evening, Sean. How are you? Luckily for me, I'm back in Dundalk, out in Ravenstill, happy at home.
And how are you finding just being there and not being able to perform apart from this upcoming gig?
Well, I mean, obviously it was a big shock for me because I was in New York and had opening night of Cenerentola on the 12th of March. We had had all the rehearsals and we had a great dress rehearsal. And at lunchtime on the day of the premiere, the day of the opening night, they cancelled. They closed the city and asked us to leave the country as soon as possible to go home. So it was a big shock to the system, but I was very lucky that my family were in New York, so I wasn't alone and we all came home together, and we then had to isolate here for the 2 weeks and everything. But again, really very lucky that I got to come home and that I wasn't on a contract somewhere where I got stuck, you know.
But pretty devastating, I would have thought, to be so close to actually performing it. And incidentally, I saw you in the Irish National Opera production of La Cenerentola, and it was brilliant, and you were brilliant in it. So it must have been very exciting for you, and then devastating at the same time. I know all the lovely stuff of having family and being able to get home, that's great, but on a professional level, huge disappointment.
It was indeed, yeah. I mean, it's 5 years ago since I signed the contract for that, so it's been something that was in the pipeline for a very long period of time. And a beautiful production and a really great cast. You know, we'd had an amazing 4 weeks rehearsals. And it's heartbreaking that we didn't get to bring it to the public because it was really special. You know, but we're all in the same boat. We're all in the same boat.
And I suppose being well and safe and home is, in the bigger picture, is obviously by far the more important things. Barry Douglas, you were actually on the road, Barry, I believe, on tour when the lockdown came. Where were you and what happened?
Good evening, Sean. Look, it was incredible because we could feel the rumblings of something happening, not just from the news, but the theatre director where we were playing, Camerata Ireland, and I, we were doing the complete Beethoven piano concertos on March 8 and 9. He was saying, we're really lucky that the concerts are going ahead tonight and tomorrow, because I think by next weekend, this theatre will be shut. It was the Opera Royale at Versailles. Hmm. And sure enough, he shut the theatre down, and then our concert in Spain a couple of days later was cancelled, and Spain was really going through a lot of problems. It was horrible what was happening there at the time. And so I stayed on for a few more days with my wife, and then we just came back to Ireland, and we've been here ever since, gardening and cooking.
A lot of that going on, I think, all around the country. But I suppose for you, Barry, you know, Tara was talking there about she had family near her. It was just her and family. They got out of America and they got home, and that was great. You had to think about the welfare and the well-being and the travelling arrangements for an entire orchestra. That must have been hugely stressful at the time.
Well, we have excellent managers at the orchestra who made sure that everybody was safe, and our French agent Ian Malcolm there in France was very, very helpful. And everybody got away. The second concert was on a Sunday afternoon, so everybody got out that night from Charles de Gaulle back to Ireland or wherever they were going. So it was
now,
okay.
I was saying in my introduction, I think apart from rehearsing in the National Concert Hall, I'd be pretty certain that this is the first time either you or Tara will be playing to a totally empty concert hall, nobody in the seats. Maybe there might be one or two people from management, or maybe some family might be able to sit in a seat or two very far apart, perhaps. How can you even get your head around, Barry, the idea that you will sit on the concert hall stage and essentially, in terms of who's there, play to nobody?
It's a very eerie proposition, I have to agree with you. It's because, I mean, apart from rehearsing, apart from making, of course, recordings, which are done in empty theatres and empty concert halls often, this is supposed to be live. It is live, but it's live on the internet. So you have to try and imagine all the people sitting at home, and just knowing that they're sitting there listening, then you have to give it your all. But the problem is you don't get the feedback, because you know, it's not just applause, it's the atmosphere as you're playing, you know, which is so important, and that'll be missing.
Yeah, because I know that I heard something today on the radio about the German Bundesliga, where in some cases, in some city, I think they either debated or possibly even put in some Atmos on the television for people, you know, the sound of a crowd cheering, or the sound of whatever it was, cheering when a goal came. But it was false. It was like canned laughter in a sitcom. I guess, Tara, what they would have to put in for a concert in the concert hall would be somebody coughing during a really quiet moment of a song, and then somebody's phone going off. Those would be useful things, wouldn't they?
War. I mean, one thing that I think we can get from this that the audience don't ever get to experience is sometimes in a rehearsal when we're still alone and the hall is empty, you can really have these quite intimate and exciting musical moments that kind of are generated from the acoustic in an empty hall. And it's something that I'm kind of happy to explore. You know, I'm somebody who feeds off the public. Really, I mean, I never can sing anything the same twice, because I really react on the energy I get from the audience. And when spoke with Dervla when the idea came about first, and like, we have had some really brilliant musical moments also alone, but that step only ever happens when you go on stage. You know, and we're so blessed to have a facility like the National Concert Hall in Dublin with this really incredible acoustic that I'm also kind of glad that people are going to get the opportunity to hear what that sounds like, you know, in the empty space, because it's something very intimate to us that we never get to share. So, you know, that's a small positive in these times.
And I guess also, Barry, you were saying that, yes, in the case of a recording, you possibly would be playing to an empty concert hall. Yeah, there'd be technicians and people moving around the place and all sorts of things. But if something goes wrong, you can say, oh, stop, can I take that again? you will have the pressure of the live performance. You won't be able to say, oh, stop, I'll start that again if you don't mind. You know, you can't really. So there is that live attention, if you like.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just going over and over in my head about how I'm going to handle this, because I have to just really make sure that my brain knows that there's a live audience there and it's not me having a bit of a practice. But I was thinking of bringing along my applause button, you know, the canned applause, you know, for the end of the piece. But no, I mean, as Tara said correctly, she's so right that this is really one of the most special halls in the world. And to be able to wallow in its space and its acoustic is a real pleasure for us.
Yeah, and as Tara said as well, we, the audience, will then get to share that reality that we wouldn't normally get to share at all. The idea of it's just you, as opposed to coming directly into our sitting rooms or our homes or wherever we're watching and listening. But now I want to start the row between the two of you, because it's about how you chose the various pieces that you were going to play. And I know that Tara had a real yen on her to sing a specific song, but Barry Douglas is going to play that specific song. So let's listen to Barry Douglas playing a very well-known Irish tune, first of all. Go, Barry Douglas in a recording there with the opening section of an arrangement of My Lagan Love. Was that what stopped you choosing to sing it, Tara Aracht?
I mean, it's so interesting. When I got the phone call and we spoke about it with the concert hall, and I usually, when you get an invitation for a recital, the promoter has a theme, or there's a theme of the season, or, you know, there's kind of a boundary within where you must plan your program. And this was wide open, blank sheet, anything you want. And I, of course, wanted to know who else was going to be there. But before I said anything, I said, oh, God, I've always wanted to do something like My Lag and Love in the Empty Hall. And then once they said Barry's name, I thought, oh, my goodness, it's a signature piece. I mean, come on, I can't do that.
So you...
But I mean, it's a beautiful thing to be given a blank sheet.
Yeah.
First of all, that they trust us enough to do that. It's madness and wonderful at the same time. Obviously, I sing in all sorts of different languages. So when you're trying to pick a program of, you know, great stories or beautiful colours or beautiful poetry, of course, you also have to add in Irish music. We are so blessed with a wealth of incredible musical heritage in this country. That to be honest, it was hard to just cut it down to an hour, you know?
Yeah. Well, I suppose, and if I know anything about you, Barry Douglas, the gentleman in you would have stepped aside immediately had you thought that Tara had that in her mind at all. But please don't do that on air now. I don't want to cause all sorts of difficulties. I mean, I know, it's kind of suggests to me, is it time for us to hear Barry playing and Tara singing together at some point that very song?
There you go.
What a wonderful idea.
Yeah, I think I may come back to both of you on that at a later point. But Barry, how then did you go about choosing? As Tara said, this, you know, the empty slate, the blank page, off you go, choose what you want. How did you, what kind of guidelines did you give to yourself?
You know, when you get an empty slate, as you say, like that, from the concert hall, it's actually really tough to choose music because you can do anything you want. And... as Tara was saying, you know, to narrow your choices is really tough. But I wanted to do something that was rich in colour and a lot of variety. And my original idea was not to have any Irish music because I know there are also others who are going to be performing traditional music. And so then I went for a walk and I came back and I said, well, I've got to do a couple of Irish pieces. And so I chose My Lag and Love and Carrickfergus. But it's just, you know, there's a piece by Schubert, a set of six pieces called Moment Musical, Musical Moments. And then there's also one by Rachmaninoff. And so I thought I've got to do these little musical moments because it's kind of splashes of colour and it'll work so well in the concert hall. And so that kind of just built up the programme. And then I thought I've got to finish with a bang. So I pictures at an exhibition by Mussorgsky, I thought would do the trick.
Certainly do that. I'm so glad that you didn't choose one of the Schubert songs that Tara had chosen for her recital. But Schubert is kind of perfect for this in some ways, Tara, because, you know, it really is. There's a chamber music quality to it. And even though you'll be in the big hall, you will actually be sending it directly into people's homes, directly into people's, you know, their headphones. It's a very intimate style of song that Schubert often gives us.
It is indeed. And I mean, for me, obviously, I have three kind of main platforms. There's opera, symphony work, or recital with piano. And recital with piano is the most intimate thing I can offer because it is really a chamber music setting. Mm. And yet the third member of that chamber music group is the audience. And it's a very kind of vulnerable thing, again, just to have the voice and piano. But Schubert wrote these incredible, incredible colours. So even when you don't know any of the text, he wrote colours in such a way that you can guess, you know, I mean, you feel it in your gut. And I think there's such, I mean, the array of Lieder he wrote, it was incredible, you know. And I just had to dip in and pick three real top hit favourites of mine. And actually all songs that I had learned with Ronnie when I was still studying in Dublin.
Ronnie Dunn,
with Veronica Dunn. And timeless classics, you know, and I think our poor hurting world is in a place at the moment where we need to remind ourselves that we can have a still moment, still full of beautiful, simple colour. It's right in front of us. It's vulnerable and, you know, and the voice has to really carry it. But I think Schubert offers us that.
Right. Well, listen, I'm going to finish up by playing one of those Schubert pieces. But first of all, before I do that, let me thank both yourself, Tara, and yourself, Barry Douglas, for joining us this evening. And I'm really looking forward to both of the concerts, because I really miss the concert hall on a Friday night.
Sure.
So it'll be lovely to have it coming into the bedroom where I am right now. It'll be able to coming into me straight after the programme on those Friday evenings. But thanks for joining us this evening, Barry Douglas and Tara Arocht. And we'll finish up. Tara is, as she said, performing three Schubert pieces. I'm going to play one of those now, Nacht und Trauma. And it features, in fact, Tara herself, accompanied by the pianist who will be performing with her on the evening, Dervla Collins. That's Tara Arocht there with the performance of Schubert's Nacht und Trauma, one of the songs that she will be performing as part of the NCH live stream series, which begins on Friday the 29th of May. Incidentally, as well as the performances themselves, our colleague John Kelly will be interviewing, doing a Zoom interview with the various performers as well. So that'll be an added dimension for you to enjoy on the evenings. Starts, as I said, on Friday the 29th of May. Concerts to be streamed live in front of that empty NCH National Concert Hall, but they'll be available worldwide to view on the National Concert Hall YouTube channel, on Facebook, and also on rte.ie. You can find out full details on nch.ie. 24 minutes past seven on Monday night's Arena. Pandemic is a new online literary journal. It has been going on since the start of the current COVID-19 crisis here in Ireland. Its founders, Joy Redmond, Liz Quirk, Ruth McKee and Niall McArdle, see it as a way of documenting these disconcerting times. And they have been receiving submissions from all over the globe. Joy Redmond joins me now to tell me a little bit more. How did the idea come about, Joy? How close was it to the start of the crisis? Was there something specific that had happened in your own life or in the lives of your co-founders? Now, we seem to be having some kind of problem there with Joy's line. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We listen to one of the pieces that has the people who contributed to the journal very kindly decided to record them for us here in on Arena. And I'd like to listen to a piece called Masking the Difference to start out with. Radka Iyer is the essayist here, and she introduces it herself.
Masking the Difference. I joined the long snaking queue outside Tesco, standing on the blue circle, 2 meters away from the person in front of me. Everyone in the queue is either wearing a mask or gloves or both. I'm wearing neither. I see eyes glancing at my face and hands. As I inch the trolley forward a few inches every few minutes, I realize I'm different. I'm the only brown person in the queue, the brown one without a mask or gloves. I vowed that for my next trip to get the groceries, I would wear a mask and gloves too. I didn't want to be different. I wanted to be like everyone else. I didn't want to stand out. I was finally like everyone else, because I was experiencing the same phenomenon of being in a lockdown, doing live workouts, trying out new recipes, spending hours on social media laughing at videos and memes, reading, cleaning, and embarking on a marathon of movies and serials. I finally belonged. A pandemic had to happen for me to feel part of society, or more accurately, a part of distanced society.
And that's Radka Iyer there with her essay Making the Difference, and that is part of one of the publications, or one of the contributions to a new literary journal called Pandemic. And one of the founders, Joy Redmond, is speaking with me this evening, and hopefully you can hear me this time, Joy, can you?
Yes, hello, good evening.
That's much better when we can actually talk to each other, even at a distance. I just played there the Radka Iyer's piece that is part of the journal, and I'll come back to you specifically about that in a moment. But I was asking you, Joy, was there something specific that had happened in either your own life or to Liz Quirk, Ruth McKee and Niall McArdle, your co-founders? Was there a specific event that made you think, I want to record this, I want this to be captured in some way, this crisis that we're going through?
Well, I suppose I was a few days or weeks ahead of the rest of the country because my son was studying in Madrid, so that was kind of a pretty dodgy space to be, you know. So well before the schools closed here and the Patrick's Day was cancelled, I was kind of on to foreign affairs trying to get him home and stuff. And then, you know, that Friday, nobody went to school and people were working remotely and all that. And then people were talking about, you know, Zoom parties and social distancing, and it was becoming just very normal. And I thought, you know, this is, you know, people are adjusting very quickly, and that's all great, but we'll adjust as quickly back to our old ways afterwards, and we might lose the opportunity to record it, you know, because if you've ever been in a situation where a family had an accident or an illness and you're suddenly in this kind of loop between home and work and hospital and you adjust and you're in kind of autopilot, but then afterwards you kind of forget that. So I just felt it's unprecedented. Hopefully we'll never experience it again. We certainly never before. So I just felt it was so important to document it. You know?
And hopefully, as you say, we will get back. I don't know if we'll get back quite as quickly as we landed in the situation, but let's hope we will get back to some kind of normality too long.
We will.
Yeah, we will do that. Who came up with the wonderful title Pandemic?
Oh, that's so strange, because we're on a little WhatsApp group, and the four of us, because we're all different places. And I had mooted the idea on the WhatsApp group, and they were saying, yeah, it's a great idea, and we're coming in with words and potential titles. And then Liz was in Kerry and Niall was in Uruguay, and at the exact same moment they both put in Pandemic, so it was like yes, you know.
Alright, well, yeah, two of them at the same time, it's extraordinary. Ideas are floating around in the universe then, it would seem, in the ether somewhere. We listened to, while we were getting the phone line sorted out there, we listened to Radhika Iyer's essay, Masking the Difference. Can you tell me much about Radhika's background, or do you know much about her?
No, she hasn't provided much, and I can only presume she's in Ireland because she's talking about Tesco, and the UK obviously has a Tesco, but they're much more multicultural. But it's fairly shocking that it took a pandemic for her to have a shared experience or a sense of belonging, you know, which I think was a very unusual angle, which I had never foreseen, you know.
It's quite shocking when she gets to the end of that essay that you realise the point that she's making. It is rather disturbing. But you have sought contributions from all over the world, all over the globe. Obviously, it's out there online. What sort of response have you been getting?
Well, it's amazing. We've published nearly 1,100 pieces. I'd say about 80 or 90% of it is poetry. So basically, we built it on the Monday before Patrick's Day, and we did a soft launch, and a few of us posted a bit. So, and then we kind of launched on Twitter on, say, the Friday after Patrick's Day. And we had kind of only put it out to our own friends and our own Twitter networks and social media. And then Ruth has Spontaneity, a literary journal, so she had a reading list there and she put it out there. And you know what I mean? But we had no anticipation that it would go global, and the amount of submissions we've had from all over the world, and especially with a .ie, we just thought it was going to go record the Irish experience. But that has been one of the most interesting parts. And it's so funny, like, you know, you could have somebody from the States and somebody from India, and they'll submit something, but it might have the exact same title, like Love in the Time of COVID, you know, like Love in the Time of Cholera by Marquez, you know what I mean? So things like that. And two things came in the other night called Ennui, from different parts of the world, and one was a poem and one was an essay, you know. So it's a universal kind of experience we're all having. The whole world has been held hostage, you know what I mean?
Poems and essay on Ennui, either of them from France?
No, just the kind of the tedium of it, you know, I suppose.
Yeah, I think maybe ennui is something that the French enjoy a lot more than the rest of us, perhaps.
Yeah.
You said that 80% of the contributions are poetry. Let's listen to one of those poems from a man. I love, he refers to himself at the end of this piece as an 18-year-old who's almost 70. And let's have a listen to this. It's a poem by Eamon Duffin. And again, he'll introduce it. He'll give the title himself.
I Wrote a Note Today by Eamon Duffin. I wrote a note today to make things easier if things go wrong. I told myself it was for my children, but it was really for me. my life on an A4 sheet of paper. Usernames, passwords, hidden questions, bank, post office, credit union details. Not much for almost 70 years of life. But I'm sure my children will fill in the blanks. I paused before signing it, wondering if my life was that clinical. But they will know who I was. So, on the bottom of the A4 sheet, I wrote the most important words I have ever written. Your dad loved you all dearly.
Extraordinary final line there. I wrote a note today, a poem by Eamon Duffin, which is part of the literary journal Pandemic, which founder Joy Hope is speaking to us about. Or Joy Redmond, Hope is a Freudian slip there, Joy, perhaps. Joy speaking to us about this evening. So if people want to submit to you, what do they have to do and how can they access the journal to read what's already there, Joy?
Well, we're pandemic.ie. And there's just a /submissions and there's a form. You just put in your name and your title and you paste. I think it's a better idea to kind of copy and paste from a Word document or something, because sometimes the form can time out if you're writing on it. And then just, they're all up there. So we have all our categories. Everything is assigned a category. And so your poetry or your essays or your drama or whatever it is, or your creative nonfiction. And you can just keep on browsing, and there's just a treasure trove of writing there. And I suppose the whole thing is, it's not just for writers, it's for anyone. We're trying to document this moment in time, a bit like the Women of the Eighth on Facebook, and they were gathering all those stories. But, you know, you could be sure that maybe 80% of them weren't writers. Now, there are some very big names on the site, and obviously, we welcome them, but we're welcoming. We don't want, history is written by the victors. We don't want this to be documented only by the writers. We want to get those different points of view,
Yeah, so it's important that you want to get that social history aspect. Well, it's certainly something worth checking out, and I certainly enjoyed flicking through it today, as I'm sure others will as well. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Joy Redmond there, and you can find out full details, as Joy said to us, on the website, which is pandemic.ie. Forty years ago today, as the band was preparing for its first North American tour, and shortly in advance of the release of the second album, Closer, the death by suicide occurred of the Joy Division frontman Ian Curtis. Despite a career which really spanned just 4 years and two albums, Curtis and the band have continued to have an enduring influence on music across the world. Curtis died at the age of 23. His life is being celebrated through a number of different online projects taking place today. Joy Division's own YouTube page is currently streaming a concert by former guitarist Peter Hook and his band The Light. That was recorded in 2015. And so this is personal. It's a 3-hour, 44-song strong concert which celebrated the life of Curtis, as I said, happening at the moment, and fans being asked to donate to Epilepsy Society, a condition that Curtis himself had. This evening, from 8 p.m. then, former Joy Division bandmates Bernard Sumner and Stephen Morris will take part in a separate event entitled Moving Through the Silence, produced in association with the Music and Mental Wellbeing Festival Headstock. And we can find out a little bit more why there are two separate events shortly. With me to discuss the enduring appeal, in fact, of Joy Division and of Ian Curtis, we have Owen Devereaux, academic from Limerick, and Neil Murray, who is the co-artistic director of the Abbey Theatre, and a huge fan of the band themselves. But let me start with you, if I could, Owen. Set the scene for me in Manchester in the 1970s. What was it that Joy Division did at that time that was so important, late 70s, early 80s?
Well, Manchester as a city was crumbling, Sean, an old industrial city literally falling apart. Punk rock happened. Bernard Sumner and Peter Hook were at that famous Sex Pistols gig, like other people like Stephen Morrissey and so on. And it was the kind of spark that lit the flame. They go on to form a band called Stiff Kittens, typical kind of punk band, and then that becomes Warsaw. And at that stage then, Ian Curtis and Stephen Morris had joined. when you think about Joy Division, you know, you mentioned there about them having two albums. I mean, Joy Division existed for 29 months. They wrote 43 songs and they played 120 gigs. And 40 years on, we're still talking about their legacy. Mm. Their legacy extends for a whole range of reasons. And I suppose my particular interest in Joy Division, apart from the phenomenal music, is that Joy Division, unlike many, many, many punk groups at the time or post-punk groups at the time, were very European in their reach. And by that, I mean the band members were listening to bands like Kraftwerk and New, and they were obsessed with Bowie's Berlin. This is why they would have called themselves Warsaw originally. But critically, Curtis was one of these really, really well-read young men who was reading Gogol, Dostoevsky, Sartre, and so on. And it's that ability, his ability, I think, to draw upon, sometimes controversially, draw upon European literature and poetry that I think brought some extra factor to Joy Division.
And I should have said in my introduction that you have co-edited a book, Heart and Soul, Critical Essays on Joy Division and lots of different aspects of Curtis's
life. Indeed, yeah, with
life.
Martin Parr and Aileen Delan.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit for later about some of the aspects of those essays.
Yeah.
But coming to you then, Neil Murray. Neil, or Owen, coming at it very much from the side of somebody hearing about these things and following through on the cultural commentary of them. You were there in 1978.
I'm the oldest man in Ireland. I was really lucky. My timing was fantastic. I went to Manchester Polytechnic in September 1978. And I partly went to Manchester because of the music scene. I really wanted to. I was aware of some of the bands coming out. I mean, to be honest, Joy Division, not any more than any others, but there was an amazing scene where in any given week you had people like the Buzzcocks, John Cooper Clarke, the Durruti Column, The Fall, and even as Owen said, you know, despite, you know, Joy Division only played 140 gigs, but you look at the list and they were playing two or three times a week in Manchester at different venues, at the Band on the Wall, the Mayflower, the Factory. So there was this real sense, and I was lucky in that. In my memory, anyway, I know I saw them twice because I checked it out again today. I saw them at the Factory on the 28th of September, 1979. And in the note next to the gig, in the listing, it says, Peter got involved in a fight during the encore, which was Peter Hook. Yeah. And I remember there was like a riot. A skinhead band called The Hamsters were supporting them, and all their friends piled on stage at the end, and Hooky brought his very heavy Rickenbacker bass down on somebody's head and all hell kicked off. And I saw them again in London, actually, in a place called the Moonlight Club in West Hampstead, playing with a certain Ratio, who were another Factory band.
Right.
So yeah, I was lucky. I was just right time, you know, right place.
You were actually there. Well, look, let's. We've been talking about them for a little while. I'm delighted that Vinnie May of Codaline is joining us on the line. But I want to listen to a little bit of Joy Division first, because Vinnie is going to be part of the event later on this evening, and we'll ask him about that. But let's have a listen to a little bit of Transmission. Dance on the radio, and that's from Transmission, a very early Joy Division song, and we're speaking about Joy Division and Ian Curtis specifically this evening on the anniversary of his death and on the occasion of a number of events, two very big online events. We've already heard from Neil Murray of the Abbey Theatre and Owen Devereux, co-editor of Heart, Soul, Critical Essays on Joy Division. But joining me now, I'm delighted to have him with us, is Vinnie May of Codaline. You're part of the event at 8 o'clock, Vinnie. What exactly will you guys be doing?
Hey, Sean. Hey, thanks.
Not so bad.
Yeah, so we got asked, we work with a charity called CAM. Over in the UK, it's specifically targeted at male kind of suicide prevention, because they find like the figures on like men not coming forward and talking about their problems is kind of staggering. So we were kind of approached by them to get involved with Headstock in Manchester, And yeah, and we jumped at the opportunity because it's something that we it's quite close to our hearts as well. Mm. Like, you know, and with kind of Steve and Mark kind of in the band suffering themselves with anxiety and depression and stuff like that, it's something that we as a band kind of know, have first-hand experience on. So we're kind of more than happy to get involved with it.
And I presume you'll be performing at home somewhere, or have you already recorded the piece that's going out, or what's going to happen?
Yeah. So, obviously we couldn't be in Manchester because it was meant to be going on basically for the past week at various venues across Manchester. So obviously that couldn't happen. So yeah, we're going live later on this evening and playing a couple of songs and then having basically then some interview and a kind of chat later on then.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a great event indeed. But Vinnie touches on it there, own Devereaux. I mentioned the book of essays that you co-edited, sure. And the chapter 8 of that book, or the 8th essay, I presume, this is the crisis I know I had to come to. And this is revisiting Ian Curtis's unfortunate death by suicide, obviously.
Indeed. Yeah.
You're really looking at the sort of things that Vinnie was talking about there, the unspoken problems.
There is a danger, you know, when you think about Joy Division, and when you think about, there is a danger that we romanticize, you know, dead rock stars and so on. And I mean, at the back of this are very, very serious issues about men and about mental health and so on. And Ian Curtis suffered quite chronically with depression. There is a sense that his depression and his anxiety may have been seriously triggered by the kind of medication that he was taking at the time. You know, so we myself and Professor David Maher, who is a psychiatrist and a GP, Walter Cullen, we literally went back and pieced together what happened to Curtis, and really it was about that, and it was more about men and mental health than Ian Curtis specifically. So there are very serious lessons to be learned from. I mean, in one sense, Joy Division and Ian Curtis's lyrics, I mean, if you wanted to tell somebody what torment sounds like and what depression sounds like and what isolation sounds like, Ian Curtis does that very, very well. But then there's the human story of him taking his life at such a young age, leaving a wife and a young child behind and so on, and very, very big issues. And I'm really glad that both the project led by Peter Hook and the project led by New Order this evening, I mean, there's a focus on epilepsy and there's a focus on men's mental health. And that's really the important aspect of all of this.
Yeah, that's not brushed over. But I suppose it is also a celebration of music. And to come back to you, Neil Murray, on that, this aspect of things, as I said, you were in Manchester in 1970. It's supposed to be studying at the Polytechnic, but now you've admitted you actually went just to get into the music scene. Was there a sense at the time when you went to a Joy Division gig that this was something different, that this was the beginning of what would become the Manchester sound, that it was really a whole new era in music?
Yeah, I mean, there was a definite scene. I mean, as I said, you had like the Buzzcocks and John Cooper Clarke, and there was a real sense of it. But I suppose because of when I was there and both bands were starting out, I kind of associate Mark E. Smith of The Fall and Ian Curtis of Joy Division, these two extraordinary, charismatic front men. I mean, completely different in how they performed, but they. For me, they were marked out differently. There was something about them and something about Ian Curtis as a performer. I mean, it's interesting, it's a different age, isn't it? There's very little material of seeing Ian Curtis performing. I mean, there's a program called Something Else, which was a BBC program, which I think is the only footage of him where they perform Transmission and She's Lost Control. And you see there, I mean, he was a hypnotic performer. But it felt dangerous. I think people knew even then that his health was fragile. There were quite a lot of cancelled Joy Division gigs back in the day for I think probably for health reasons or maybe other reasons. So he was such an incredible performer that my memory of seeing them was just being fixed on him. Although, you know, they were all great to look at. You know, Peter Hook played his bass down his ankles, and you know, Stephen Morris is a phenomenal drummer. But there was something about Ian Curtis as a front man, just in the centre of the stage. I don't ever remember him speaking to the audience. you know, he almost went into a trance, and that's what my memory is of seeing them. And as Owen said, that's slightly, that different sound. I mean, they were certainly developing it then. This is 79 and 1980. That sense of, they were, to me, I was 19, 20. They were a punk band, but they were a punk band with a very different sound to, say, the Buzzcocks. They weren't a pop group in that sense.
And when you listen, Sean, to bands now, so if you listen to the drum patterns in The National, if you listen to Interpol, most obviously, like the legacy, the resonance of Joy Division, and particularly Stephen Morris's drumming patterns, they're really still very, very, very prevalent. Could I just stress, though, that I think there's an interesting aspect of Joy Division and Ian Curtis. I mean, there were at least three or four others who are part of that bigger story, you know, the design of Peter Saville, Martin Hammett, their producer. I mean, again, the work he did with them in terms of how he literally cut and paste their sounds together. Tony Wilson, obviously, in sort of creating the Joy Division myth and so on. And their manager, Rob Gretton, at the time, who kind of orchestrated that they wouldn't do a whole lot of interviews and so on. So it's a kind of an interesting amalgamation of Curtis's literary leanings, great production, great sound, and in some respects, Joy Division songs, the early songs, and I'm saying this as a basic enough musician, they're actually easy enough to play, but it's what they do with their musical instruments and how they play so forcefully is really what makes it so great.
I'll go to you then, Vinnie May of Codaline. You'll be part of the gig, as you've told us, Vinnie, at 8 o'clock a little bit later on, the online performance. But the lads were talking about the kind of legacy of Joy Division and the great music that it spawned. Now, you weren't listening to Joy Division back in 1980, I don't think. When did you first come across the music?
For me, I suppose it's probably like Love Will Tear Us Apart. Obviously, it's kind of the song that I suppose people of my generation and younger will kind of recognize straight away. So I suppose hearing that song, first of all, and then listening to New Order then as well, kind of made me go back and listen to Joy Division. I won't lie and say that they had a massive influence on me and me growing up and music, but I was definitely aware of the impact that they did have, although it'd be very short-lived as a touring band, you know. But they are kind of one of the bands that people still talk about, people still listen to the two albums, like, you know, and still go back and reference those stuff, like the guys were saying, from bands that are out at this moment, like, you know, and you only have to listen to some of that stuff, like The National as well, and the influences from Joy Division and from New Order as well.
I was saying, Owen, that I'd ask you a little bit about why there are two separate events. There's a kind of a tragedy, a terrible sadness to the enmity, really, between Hook and it's more Hook and Summer than Hook and Morris.
Yeah, it seems to be focused on that. I mean, you know, there was a long history of sort of internal rivalries within New Order, and then, you know, Peter Hook left, and there was a split, and so on. And then, as is often the case in rock music, the legals got involved. The legal aspects of things has been settled about royalties and about his ability to use the name and so on. But it's interesting because I've seen Peter Hook and the Light several times, and in fact, my colleagues and we brought him to Limerick to perform the two Joy Division albums a number of years ago, and I've seen New Order as well, and my money would really be on Peter Hook and the Light in terms of performing Joy Division songs now. I had a funny experience last summer. I saw Peter Hook in the Royal Albert Hall with an orchestra, with some female singers, there was a guy, initially I thought it was a hologram, it was a guy who was literally the image of Ian Curtis performing Joy Division songs. And then a couple of days later in Trinity, I saw New Order do their Ian Curtis tribute, if you like, and I just think Hook at this stage carries it off much better. His voice is more suited to it, and I think it's more on the money.
Do you remember, Neil Murray, how you heard or where you were when you heard of the death of Ian Curtis?
Yeah, I mean, this is really tricky. I was talking about people that last night about this. In my head, I'm actually in the Factory Club in Manchester when we hear. And there was a spoken word guy, a kind of a pound shop, John Cooper Clarke, called John the Postman.
Oh, yeah.
Who used to perform a lot at the Factory. And we were there, it was a very quiet night, but in my memory, Tony Wilson is there and somebody late at night says Ian Curtis has died. And there's a kind of weird thing and nobody quite believes it really. And then the next day it was in the kind of Manchester Evening News. So I absolutely, I remember within, whether that first bit is true or I've completely made it up, I don't know. But it's in my head, that's where I am.
That's what happened. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a story that the story that goes is that Teardrop Explodes were playing at Eric's in Liverpool, and that Julian Cope heard about it first and phones Tony Wilson to tell him. But I don't know. It's one of those stories that's been mythologized, like much of Joy Division and Ian Curtis's really short life.
And Ian, I was, just earlier today on Twitter, I was retweeting John Peel announcing it on the 19th. So it was a day, again, pre-internet. So it was a day after the 19th on Peel's programme. You know, he says, bad news, lads, I've just heard.
Yeah.
And he plays Joy Division. And, I remember it very well.
We'll finish up. Do you remember where you were when you first heard that you were talking about Love Will Tear Us Apart, Vinnie May? Do you remember where it was you first heard that song? Do you remember your first listening?
It was in a movie now, like, depress me on the name of the movie, I couldn't tell you, but I'm pretty sure that song has been used about a million times in different movies and different TV shows. It is a song that that could have been written, like, yesterday. The lyrics are still so very fitting for how a lot of people are kind of dealing with, like, and you can kind of tell the kind of the anguish in his voice as well and in the lyrics, so I think it's something that still rings very true to this day.
All right, well, let's have a listen to a little bit of Love Will Tear Us Apart as we finish up this evening. Tear Us Apart, and a reminder that the official Joy Division YouTube channel is currently streaming Peter Hook and the Lights concert. So this is personal, that one's called. You're encouraged to pay tribute to Ian Curtis by making a donation to the Epilepsy Society. That's just about finishing up now. The event featuring Codaline, Vinnie May, thanks to him for speaking with us this evening. Brandon Flowers of The Killers and former Joy Division members Bernard Summer and Stephen Morris. That's called Moving Through the Silence, produced in association with the Music and Mental Wellbeing Festival Headstock. That's available later this evening on unitedwestream.co.uk. And we should also mention, when we mention Headstock on that charity, our own charity here at home, pieta.ie and aware.ie, and also good places to check out if you're not in the best of places for any reason this evening. Thanks also to Owen Devereaux, co-editor of Heart and Soul, critical essays on Joy Division, and Neil Murray, co-artistic director of the Abbey Theatre, telling us about his time in Manchester in the 70s and 80s. But that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Even Nikki Dempsey was on sound this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Research was by Paula Shields and Leah Murphy. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.